8. vydání Hovorů od křivého stolu. Jsem tady zase já, Martin Čimeček, se mnou Honza Pospíšil.
Ahoj.
A my jsme pro tenhle vydání vyměnili všechny křivé stoly, které máme v pražské kanceláři, a přesunuli jsme se do Redmondu. A sedíme u křivého stolu, který je v Channel 9 studiu. Takže se nám tak trošku splnil vlhký sen a jsme konečně tam, kde se děje veškerá ta magie. A je to zvláštní zážitek. Tohle vydání bude speciální. Jsme tady na technickém školení, jsme přímo v centrále a máme dvě velká témata, o kterých se hlavně mluví. A potom jsme si ještě připravili rozhovory se třemi důležitými lidmi, kteří mají něco společného s vývojem. Budeme si povídat o vývoji C#, budeme si povídat o vývoji TypeScriptu a o Xamarinu. Takže posečkejte a teď se vrhneme na ta hlavní technologická
témata. Máme se na co těšit a jdem na to. Hodně se tady teď mluví o v podstatě dvou věcech. Jedno jsou microservices a ta druhá velká oblast je bot framework. Takže pojďme se na ně podívat trošku víc do hloubky.
Začni s microservices.
Microservices. Microservices začalo být docela žhavé téma ve chvíli, kdy poprvé přišel Docker jako druh microservices, kontejnerová služba. Všichni o tom mluví, všichni to hrozně chtějí. Každý, kdo chce být in, tak musí v každé své debatě aspoň jednou Docker nebo něco podobného zmínit. Samozřejmě i my jsme na to zareagovali jako Microsoft. A krom toho, že nabízíme Docker jako takový, jak ten klasický Docker Linuxový, který si můžete rozjet na Azure, tak nabízíme i Dockerové kontejnery přímo na Windows, kde běží Windows. Ale krom toho, vedle microservices, toho nabízíme daleko víc. Nejenom, že můžete uzavřít svůj kód do kontejneru typu Docker, ale můžete ho rozjet i v rámci Service Fabriku. Service Fabrik je ta technologie, která vám umožňuje vaše kousky kódu zabalit jako mikroservisy a rozházet je po serverech. Mikroservisy v zásadě mohou být dvojího druhu. Stateful anebo stateless. Jedny takové, které když umřou nebo nemají zrovna co dělat, tak si uchovávají svůj stav, drží si nějaký svůj kontext, můžeme to tak říct. A pak takové, které prostě se jenom probudí, když je třeba, vykonají, co mají a zapomenou v podstatě všechno, co měli k sobě svázané. Typicky pomocí Service Fabriku můžete vytvářet API. Ty API můžou být, jak už jsem řekl, stateful nebo stateless. Stateless API můžou být takové, kde prostě dodáte balík dat se zpracuje, vrátí se zpátky. Stateful jsou takové, kde to zpracování záleží na tom, co už jste udělali předtím. Mají nějaký svůj kontext a potřebují si pamatovat poslední sekvenční číslo či cokoliv. O takové servisy se vůbec pak nemusíte starat. Nemusíte se starat o ten kontext, veškeré ukládání se děje automaticky na pozadí a ta servisa tam může ležet klidně několik dní, týdnů, měsíců, let, když na to přijde. Probudí se ve chvíli, kdy ji potřebujete, kdy ji zavoláte, rehydratuje si ten svůj stav a vy pokračujete ve zpracování. Krom API nabízíme i další možnost, jak interagovat v Service Fabriku. A to jsou takzvané ACT3. ACT3 je v podstatě kousek kódu, který reprezentuje něco, co má typicky vykonávat. A vy ho zase zavoláte, něco udělá a odchází do ústraní, kde odpočívá a čeká na další zavolání. Velkou výhodu to má v tom, že všechno je tam typové. A v podstatě vy si vytváříte jednotlivé instance těch aktrů a každá ta instance má vlastní kontext. Není to tak, že jeden kontext společný úplně pro všechno. Obecně microservices je docela široké téma, takže koukněte se do odkazů pod videem, budete tam mít materiály, jak zkusit vytvořit svoji první servisu, jak je nasadit. Velká výhoda je v tom, že i testování může probíhat u vás lokálně, nepotřebujete k tomu plný Azure, abyste to museli někam nasadit, ale u vás si můžete vytvořit farmu serverů, na které potom nasazujete ty servisy a dokonce to potom ani v produkci nemusí běžet v Azure, ale postupně bude možnost si svoje mikroservisy rozjet víceméně kdekoliv. On-premise u nějakého jiného hostera nebudete nutně svázáni pouze s Azurem, takže využití bude hodně široké, podobně jako třeba s Dockerem.
Myslím, že Azure Service Fabric je teď hodně žhavá technologie právě na hyperškalovatelné aplikace a backendy pro masivní multiplayerové hry a podobně. Viděli jsme spoustu zajímavých demíček a o některá z nich si můžeme i podělit. Další velké téma je konverzace jako platforma. Mluví se o tom teď všude, internety jsou plné botů a umělé inteligence a kdesi, cosi. Microsoft to pojal tradičně po svém a prostě nabízí platformu. Chcete dělat konverzaci s uživatelem, chcete pomocí téhle konverzace dosáhnout toho, že si u vás něco koupí nebo že vyřeší nějaký svůj problém? Fajn, máme pro vás platformu, která umožní vašeho konverzačního agenta, tím je třeba bot, může jim být třeba e-mail, může jim být API, napojí na různé komunikační služby. Tím pádem uživatel si nemusí stahovat novou speciální aplikaci, service desk, e-shop, cokoliv, ale používá Skype, používá Facebook, používá ten Canvas, na který je zvyklý, přes který s ním komunikují jeho kamarádi a další lidé. Microsoft Bot Framework je technologie, která se dočkala nedávno updateu a pořád se aktualizuje, pořád se vyvíjí. V podstatě ji tvoří dvě velké části. Je to konektor a je to builder. Konektor slouží k tomu, aby opravdu jste mohli vzít svoje web API, které může být napsané třeba v Node, může být napsané v ASP.netu, může být napsané v podstatě v čemkoliv jiné, musí to být jenom webové APIčko, a napojí ho na Skype, na Facebook, na Slack, na další různé kanály, třeba Twilio pro SMSky. A tímhle způsobem dokáže předávat transparentně zprávy a vy se nemusíte starat o konkrétní implementaci. Co na vás ale zůstává pořád, je ta samotná logika. Takový ten if-else strom, který musí každý bot projít, nějaké rozhodování, nějaká analýza jazyka a tak dále.
Všichni známe ty telefonní automaty.
Přesně tak, takzvaná plechová huba, to je i perfektní příklad takového bota. No a druhá část, ten builder, se stará o to, aby vám zjednodušila právě tuhle druhou část. To budování té samotné logiky. Takže v součástí SDKčka, které je zase k dispozici pro .NET a pro Node.js, můžete tvořit dialogy, můžete je řetězit, můžete pozbírat data od uživatele, nechat ho v podstatě vyplnit formulář a pak navazovat další konverzací. A tohle všechno, když použijete, spojíte to dohromady, hodíte to do internetu, hodíte to na bot framework, tak on se pak postará o to, aby uživatelé mohli vašeho bota používat třeba ve Skypeu. Co jsme tady viděli na konferenci, byl moc hezký bot a velice praktický bot, který vám umožnil podívat se do vašeho seznamu přednášek, které vás čekají na té konferenci, a podívat se, kam máte jít. A opravdu to funguje tak, že mu napíšete, co teď, no, what's up now, nebo what's up. A ono vám vrátí, jaká je vaše další přednáška. Nebo si můžete prolistovat celý program. A ukázalo se, že prakticky je to mnohem rychlejší a mnohem praktičtější, než spouštět aplikaci na mobilu, načítat web, logovat se, čekat, než se všechno naloaduje, procházet program. Zeptat se jednou bota a získat odpověď během 2 vteřin je mnohem rychlejší, než procházet tou aplikací. Nečekal jsem to, ale opravdu se to tak stalo.
Velkou výhodou obecně botů je to, že neběží na té dané komunikační platformě, ten bot neběží na Skypeu, ten bot neběží na Slacku, ale běží někde a ty komunikační kanály mu můžete přidávat. Takže čistě teoreticky můžete udělat to, že rozjedete konverzaci na jednom kanále, jste v práci, píšete si s ním přes Skype či cokoliv jiného, sednete do auta, tam máte jiný komunikační kanál, dokonce to může být, jako když bude nějaký převodník na hlas, tak to může být i hlas. Přijdete domů, tam si pustíte zase něco dalšího a můžete přeskakovat jednotlivé komunikační kanály a pořád budete v tom svém kontextu, pořád ten bot bude vědět, co se od vás doptal.
Přesně tak, to je vynikající point, protože i když se přihlásíte, třeba zalogujete se na Skypeu na mobilu, tak jakmile pustíte tu konverzaci na Skypeu na počítači, tak pořád jste přihlášení, protože ten bot si to prostě pamatuje. To je jedna z velkých výhod tady tohohle způsobu. Na druhou stranu neříkáme, že úplně všechno by měl dělat bot. Občas jako jsou vidět takové hlasy a trendy, že boti všude, na všechno se hodí bot. Já si myslím, že to není pravda. Že jsou situace, na které se bot vyloženě hodí a tam má přínos, a naopak je většina scénářů, kde to prostě nemá smysl. Kde je rychlejší naklikat to na webu, je rychlejší někam zavolat a vyřešit to rovnou s člověkem. Takže je třeba uvažovat, který scénář zvolit, případně ho použít třeba jenom na část toho workflow a zbytek dodělat tradičně. Ale myslím si, že má tu budoucnost tato technologie.
Martin to zmínil několikrát, že ten bot je dobrý na to procházení toho stromu, ty telefonní automaty, co to známe, to je perfektní ukázka. Vždycky zvažujte při použití bota, jestli náhodou už nestavíte umělou inteligenci. V případě, kdybyste začali stavět umělou inteligenci, už je něco špatně. V případě, kdybyste potřebovali v uvozovkách znásilnit kontext, už je něco špatně. Jedna z věcí, kterou jsme se tady mimo jiné dozvěděli, a zároveň to i ukazuje, kde je ta hranice mezi botem a kde je ta hranice mezi AI, je, že bot může docela dobře fungovat ve spojení třeba i s Cortanou. Cortana je něco, co má v sobě tu inteligenci a bot je to něco, co vám ji dokáže doručit nějakým zajímavým způsobem. Viděli jsme bohužel už i u partnerů, kde se snažili z bota udělat v podstatě druhou Cortanu nebo druhou Siri a většinou to nedopadlo úplně dobře.
Ano. Tohle procházení toho logického stromu značně zjednodušuje právě ten poslední update, který zanáší funkci takzvaných karet, kdy můžete tím botem na kanálech, které to podporují, to znamená v současnosti na Skypeu a na Facebooku a na Slacku, poslat kartu, která v sobě má tlačítka. A může tam mít třeba i obrázek, může tam mít nadpis a nějaký popisek. A tímhle způsobem, aniž by uživatel musel psát odpovědi, což se hodí zvlášť na mobilu, ho můžete navigovat tím rozhodováním a ukazovat mu možnosti, které vlastně má a kudy se může vydat. Zároveň můžete třeba nabídnout z výběr z několika, typicky když si rezervuje hotelový pokoj, tak může dostat na výběr třeba z 5 různých typů pokojů, on si zvolí, který ho zajímá a může pokračovat dál pak v tom objednávání. Takže tyhle nové funkce, které se objevily v V3 API, rozhodně stojí za prozkoumání. Další, která tam přibyla a je hodně zajímavá, je preview hlasových hovorů na bota a 1:1 ve Skypeu. Takže přesně takový ten rozhodovací automat, kterému zavoláte, může už dneska být naprogramovaný jako vaše vlastní API, jako váš bot, který naslouchá na Skypeu, člověk mu zavolá, on mu dokáže i nějakým způsobem reagovat. Dneska to funguje v angličtině, když zainvestujete do rozpoznávání jazyka českého, tak vám to bude fungovat i česky.
Jedna věc, která mě teď napadá, kterou už jsem taky párkrát viděl a v podstatě i nám ji tady ukazovali, měl jsem z toho takovou trošku rozpolcenou mysl, bylo, kde bot framework byl použitý pro integraci třetostranných služeb. Typicky to může vypadat tak, že váš bot framework vám bude pomáhat například bukovat letenky. Vy mu napíšete, kam chcete letět, on vám dá možnosti, vy si vyberete. A ve chvíli, kdy si vyberete, tak bot ví, kam letíte, kdy tam budete a může vám nabídnout pomoc třeba i zabukovat ubytování. A v tu chvíli přichází ta rozpolcenost, že bot může přizvat dalšího bota, který slouží pro rezervaci hotelového pokoje a dva boti mezi sebou si můžou popovídat a ve výsledku vám jenom nabídnou, máme takovýhle pokoj za tolik, vy to potvrdíte a ty boti si domluví ten zbytek.
To je zvlášť taková už lehce funkční, ale zatím spíš budoucnost. Mohlo by to tak dopadnout. Takže pokud uvažujete o tom, jestli třeba do své aplikace nebo do svého produktu zahrnout bota nebo nějakou takovou konverzační platformu, určitě stojí za to se zamyslet nad tím, abyste měli ten správný scénář. Zamyslet se nad tím, zda má smysl pokoušet se vůbec třeba analyzovat jazyk. Jestli opravdu dává smysl snažit se o konverzaci s tím uživatelem, anebo mu radši dát na výběr ABC, 1, 2, 3, 4, ano, ne. Protože takováhle interakce je nakonec nejrychlejší. Když si chci objednat pizzu a musím 4x kliknout na webu, tak je to mnohem příjemnější, než když musím napsat 50-60 znaků, jakože ahoj, chci si objednat pizzu. Tam je to takové na hraně. Takže proto je třeba se nad tím zamyslet, jakmile ten scénář najdete, vyberte si správnou technologii, jednou z nich je třeba bot framework, my ho můžeme určitě doporučit. A pak konverzujte s uživateli.
To je samozřejmě na pozadí vaše API v Service Fabriku, jak jinak.
Pochopitelně. Dost řečí, pojďme na slíbené rozhovory. Máme
Vrněme
tady
se na to.
Hned první oběť. Máme tady první oběť, její Mats Torgersen, člověk, který stojí za C-Sharpem a byl tak ochotný, že nám odpoví na pár zajímavých otázek. So, hi Mats, thank you for being with here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Could you briefly introduce yourself to our viewers?
Well, my name is Mats Torgersen, as I think you said in the intro, and I am the program manager for the C-Sharp language at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. So, what I do is essentially drive the language design process. Whenever we decide to put new features into C-Sharp, that's me sort of coordinating that.
So you're responsible for all the great stuff that's happening in C-Sharp recently.
Yes, I'm to blame. Ultimately. I don't get all the ideas necessarily, but I'm the one who kind of helps pull it together and drive it to the right design at the end, decide what goes in and what doesn't.
Okay, so connected to this is the first question. What does it take to design a language for people who have no idea, like myself?
That's a good question. I actually never had the pleasure of designing a language truly from scratch. So I don't know what it takes. I don't know what it takes to start one. That's probably a lot more confusing. But for now, it's really a matter of trying to. You always get a lot of input. Once you have a language that's popular and out there, you get a lot of input. People are struggling with various things and they have many ideas. There are certainly other programming languages out there that often have great solutions for problems that we can steal and fit to our own purposes. And so it's very much it's sort of a combination of trying to discern what's important for the language and for its users, and then so there's some of that work, and then there's a lot of design work that is more technical, which is about making the feature fit well into C#, mm-hmm. whether it's one that we came up with or one that we're stealing, working on it so that it's kind of in the spirit of the language, if you will. And then there's the third the most technical part of it probably is how can we implement this so that it's efficient and works well with other features and so on.
So it's a lot about balance.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah, and so I have a design team that is we call it the LDM, the Language Design Meeting. That is a bunch of people from the C# team and elsewhere that we sit in a room 4 hours every week. And work through details mm-hmm. and discuss and hammer out proposals. And so there's a group of people that kind of does the design together. I think every time you need to do good design, you need to do it in a collaborative mm-hmm. way. It's really hard for one mind. There's only a few minds in the world, I think, that can just do that on their own and get all the trade-offs right. You sort of need to have a discussion and have different viewpoints. And oftentimes, after we've had a long and exhausting battle about something, there's a third option in the middle that's the right one that we can land on. And so that very collaborative process, both with the larger community and with that core group of designers, is essential for making the right decisions for the language. Mm-hmm.
So Matt, you already mentioned it. So there are so many languages out there. So how the others influence the C#? And is there anything like what does C# make stand out? Is there anything you can point it out like this is the feature why you should choose the C# in front of the others?
Right. So at the end of the day, it's a combination of everything, right? But there are certain things. Well, C#, like a few languages, has a very very strong ecosystem and set of core stuff that's available. It's a rock-solid, industry-grade language, right? So it has that going for it compared to some other languages. There's some features that are truly unique, or that at least are unique until others are copying us on it, like async, for instance. The way we addressed async was, I think, truly innovative and put us as a leader in the market. That's very important in this world where everything is essentially a distributed application. You have devices like the thing on the table in front of you, connected to services and to each other and so on. And everything needs to deal with latency and distribution, concurrency. And so async was really a step forward, I think, for the industry, I want to say unmodestly, where we're just ahead. If you look at complicated async code in C#, it just looks better than in almost any other language.
Okay, so this is what makes C# unique.
It's one of the things. I don't want to single out a thing, but I think it shows that we are very even though C# is not a young language anymore, we're very aggressive to keep it at the forefront of what you can do in languages to make it, even as it is, it is a mainstream programming language that needs to appeal to large groups of developers. It can't be like for a niche or for a particular elite or whatever. That said, we are pretty aggressive in moving it forward and adopting modern idioms. That was the same with Link, which was also, it was using idioms and features that we didn't invent them. They were already prevalent in functional programming languages, but we really took something and we mainstreamed it and took the language, made the language competitive by bringing something to the mainstream, working it into you know, an imperative, a general purpose language, and making it fit well there. So we have this philosophy of keeping C# very much at the you know, at the front end of
on the
of programming languages, so that we don't stop being a relevant option for new projects. We want to be something that people would happily pick up and
like
use
first
for
choice.
And use for a new project, even maybe if they haven't used it before. So in order to do that, we need to stay modern. We need to be as productive and efficient as some of the newer programming languages are.
Okay. Maybe can we take a look into the kitchen a bit? So what's cooking? What's new? What's like the plans for the future?
Well, at this particular time, I just actually sent out an email, I think last Friday, a week ago, from where we're recording this, that we are now making the last major design decision for C# 7.0. That's what, so C# 7 has tuples, it has pattern matching, and a few other features. It's really coming to, you know, a close. We're done mulling over the design decisions. We're almost done implementing it, and it's sort of getting ready to go. And so, actually, in a couple of weeks, we'll put our gaze on what's next on the horizon. We have a lot of things that are already in the works that we think are candidate features for C# 8 or whatever it's going to be called, both big and small. Like some of the big ones are that we I would like us to make progress on are making a system for handling nullability of reference types. So reference types were always nullable whether you wanted them to or not in the .NET stack, and you could never express your intent. Is this thing supposed to be null or not? And the language would therefore never be able to tell you whether you were risking null reference exceptions or whatever. And so if we can put a way into the language of expressing your intent with reference types, is this field or this return type or is it supposed to be null or not? People always know when they, or they should know, they should have thought it through when they publish an API, right? But they don't have a language way of saying it today. And we want to put that in, and we're going to put in the checks that will then, no pun on your nationality, we want to put in the checks to to help you find when you're not using things according to their intent. And another thing I would like to try to focus on is sort of taking the next step of async. Async is great now for single values you're waiting for. If we can take it to sort of async streams, things that are coming at you with you know, with delay, things that are streaming to you over time, for single values, async helped us get rid of callbacks from the code. Callbacks always lead to complexity, and if it doesn't, it's because you're not done yet. It's because you have bugs. So if you can get rid of callbacks also for you know, stream processing, if you will, if you could imagine writing a for each loop over something that comes to you little by little, and then you sort of just, the for each loop itself is just awaiting whenever things aren't ready. So it's that kind of thing that I think would be the next step in the async journey.
So lots of really cool stuff.
Yeah. So if we can, so that's my ambition. Let's see if we can work it out. If we can go through that design process and make it all, you know, feasible on the platform, attractive as part of C#, and you know, just make it work. There's a lot of work ahead of us, but yeah, we have plans.
Perfect.
So when you're starting a new project, new hobby project, whatever, what's your first language of choice? Do you try to explore, or is it C sharp, and if I can't do it in C sharp, I do it in something else.
You know, first of all, I do much too few hobby projects. I'm not good enough actually at carving out time to do so. I will usually do it in C sharp because I want to try something in C sharp. So let me put it like this: whenever I start a new project, I do it because I want to do something in the language.
Oh, right.
So maybe if I want to try something out in a competitive language, I will start in that language. But I don't have a language of choice that I would go to for my own purposes. I probably should have a more lively, hidden life as someone with hobby projects. But at the end of the day, I end up spending most of my time on C sharp.
Okay. One last question. How long does it take to get from Seattle to Prague?
I would say probably 14 hours.
Wow. You're right,
yes,
actually.
You're right.
It's exactly right, depending on the flights. Good.
Well, I'm from Denmark, so I can, it's a similar distance. So
you didn't forget. Okay. Thank you very much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. We really appreciate your time and your insights, and I hope our viewers will as well.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been great.
Thank you.
Další obětí, kterou jsme nalákali do Channel 9 studia, je Bowden Kelly, člověk, který je zodpovědný a stará se o TypeScript, takže ho zkusíme vyspovídat, co se chystá, co se mu líbí a tak dál. Hello, Bowden. Thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate your time. Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Bowden Kelly. I'm a program manager on the TypeScript team. I've been with Microsoft for a little over a year, but I've been working on JavaScript and related technologies for about 7 or 8 years now. And I'm excited to be here.
Good. So you work with JavaScript. What's the most confusing or mind-boggling thing you've ever encountered in JavaScript?
Just in general, the equals, double equals, triple equals phenomenon in JavaScript that doesn't exist anywhere else is just absolutely outrageous. The fact that you learn to program, you learn that, double equals is for, assessing equivalence, and then JavaScript says, no, you always use triple equals for that, and double equals does something different. That's just mind-boggling.
Yeah. Does TypeScript solve it in any way?
Yes. TypeScript in 2.0 is going to be releasing non-nullable types, and what this does is it lets you keep track of both undefined and null, which are their own types in JavaScript. And this is really cool for several reasons, mostly that when we track nullability throughout your program, you no longer have to worry about keeping track of where things can be null or where they can be undefined or if you use the right double equals or triple equals. TypeScript will keep track of all of that for you.
So no more null hell.
Yes, no more null hell, yes.
So we as a Microsoft are kind of known for C#. So even most of our viewers are into the C#. So what you can recommend to C# developers, like what should be the ramp up to start with a TypeScript?
So the beauty of TypeScript for C# developers is it's very familiar. Mm-hmm. It should be comfortable. And we bring back things like classes and interfaces and all these things you're expecting in a strong object-oriented language, as well as static types. But in general, you can get going writing JavaScript the way you're familiar with writing C#. You can, have one class per module, and you can export default that module, and all of these things will feel very natural to you as a C# developer. Mm-hmm. I will note that at the end of the day, TypeScript is still JavaScript, so it's important that you understand the foundation of JavaScript if you truly want to feel very comfortable in TypeScript. But TypeScript will provide you that familiar environment, and it will give you kind of handlebars to using JavaScript that make you feel like you're in a C# world. Okay.
And how about the projects having tons of JavaScript already? Can it be somehow combined with the TypeScript?
Absolutely. Anything that's JavaScript today can be converted to TypeScript. You can use a new flag called allow.js to start piping all of your JavaScript through the TypeScript compiler, which lets you kind of work with JavaScript and TypeScript together. Or you can take all of your JavaScript files and just flip them to TS, and right out of the box, all JavaScript is valid TypeScript, because TypeScript is a superset of JavaScript.
So does it mean that you can combine the old JavaScript with the TypeScript in one and only project and be compiled together?
Yes, absolutely. Using the allow.js flag, you can have both TypeScript and JavaScript together in the same project running through the same compiler.
perfect. That's cool.
And if you go to back to the original question, for me as a C# developer, I've seen a presentation about TypeScript. I see, wow, this is the new hype. I love it. I love how it works. What should I do next? How to start?
I would encourage you to check out our website, typescriptlang.org. We have a ton of documentation up there on how to get started. We have specific guides for how to get started with ASP.NET or other things that you may be more familiar with. But at the end of the day, you can just go to your command line and do npm install -g TypeScript, and you're up and running.
Okay.
Maybe how about the TypeScript and tooling? How it's fit together with Visual Studio, maybe even Visual Studio Code?
If you use Visual Studio, you'll get TypeScript out of the box with any installation you have by default. And if you're in VS Code, you also get TypeScript out of the box by default. With any new versions coming down the road, you will need to do an additional out-of-band install for Visual Studio. But you can just open up a TypeScript in either of those editors and get going right away.
Oh, that's awesome.
Good. You mentioned TypeScript 2.0. What's coming in this new version, and when is it coming?
That's a great question. we've got a ton of stuff coming in TypeScript 2.0. I talked about non-nullable types, control flow analysis. We have a whole new system for fetching DTS files, which are TypeScript declaration files. Those let you work more closely with JavaScript and TypeScript together. We've revamped that whole system, and that will be available starting in 2.0. There's a bunch of little things like module resolution strategies, UMD module declarations, all sorts of stuff. If you want to see the full list, you can check out our GitHub page and check out on our wiki what's new. And there's a full list of all the features that are coming in 2.0.
Perfect. That's great.
Okay, one last question. How long does it take to get from Seattle to Prague?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Just put a wild guess.
16 hours.
Almost.
Oh, pretty close.
It's a little less. It's 13:40.
Depends.
Yeah. It can take 20s. So you're in the right range.
There we go.
Great. Cool. Thank you very much for your time. You enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. It was great. Maybe really the one last. So speaking about your hobby project, I hope you have some time to do that hobby project. What's the language of your first choice? Is it TypeScript?
It is TypeScript. Right now, my pet project is working with D3, which is a visualization library in JavaScript. And if you've ever worked with D3, you know that it is relentless when it comes to passing in the correct properties and parameters into all of their functions. And TypeScript takes that whole mess and really turns it into a beautiful, powerful framework. You get all of the power of D3, but you get like the productivity and the protection of working in a beautiful development environment.
That's inspiring.
Give it a shot. You should definitely give it a shot.
Okay, then thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No a my ještě nekončíme. Čeká nás poslední oběť. Posledním odvážlivcem, který se k nám přidal v Channel Lines studiu, je James Montemagno, což je člověk zodpovědný za Xamarin. Určitě jste o něm slyšeli nebo z toho viděli, protože i hodně evangelizoval tuhle technologii a odpoví nám pár otázek. So, hello James. Hey. Nice to have you here. Thank you for your time. Could you briefly introduce yourself first?
Well, first, I love that, even in Czech, you said my name perfect, by the way. Many people here in the US can't even do that. So I'm James Montemagno. I'm a principal PM on the Xamarin team. I've worked at Xamarin for 3 years. I was actually, before that, a customer building apps with Xamarin. So I've been crafting apps with Xamarin for the last 5 years. So really, what I do here is essentially kind of spread the knowledge and love and passion for Xamarin to enable developers to create apps in C# for iOS and Android and Mac. Yeah,
perfect.
Great. We have many developers who know .NET, who know C#, even some who create Windows Store applications, UWP. What's the recommended path, you would say, for those people to switch to cross-platform or learn and explore?
Sure. So that's where I was 5 years ago, right? So I started writing, WPF apps, Silverlight apps, and WCF services, all this really .NET foundation. And when I went to mobile, it was great because essentially all of that .NET skills, like writing models, view models, RESTful service calls, SQL databases, Azure integration, it's all the same. It's just .NET code.
And as .NET developers, especially when it came to Windows Store and UWP, that MVVM approach was really shoved down our throats, if you will. It was really enforced, even in the default template. So you just say, well, listen, my view's over here. It's off to the side. You're going to be my view, and you're going to be in my models and my view models. And like this code right here is shared. It's ready to go because it doesn't care about, you know, it's good friends with the view. But I can sit in the middle, and then this is just some binding framework that's sitting here. And what's great about Xamarin is that you're going to know all of the 70, 80% of your code, and then you're going to learn a little bit of iOS, Android, user interface, the APIs, or with Xamarin Forms, you can learn one cross-platform user interface and write all that in XAML. But I always kind of recommend, it's like, it's good, you come to a new platform, learn a little bit of iOS, learn a little bit of Android, then look at Xamarin Forms and see what you like, what you kind of, you know, tend towards. I like Android a lot and Xamarin Forms a lot. And that was really nifty because since I came from a WPF XAML-y world, I knew all the data bindings, converters. Mm-hmm. Like you're almost ahead in that world, which is really nice. So just going to that, the place I started 5 years ago, and I tell everyone, is developer.xamarin.com. Literally on there, there's like an iOS section, an Android section, a Xamarin Forms section. That's 1, 2, 3. It's like creating your first page, doing navigation, learning some of the APIs, and it takes like a few hours. And that's going to give you the building blocks of why does iOS look and feel this way, and how does it navigate? How do you get down to the APIs? You're doing it all in C#, right? So you have access to everything.
You said you've been there like starting with Xamarin like 5 years ago. So what's your recommendation to start with? Together with Xamarin, even Xamarin Forms, or try to do some backend or common functionality in Xamarin and then go for a platform-specific UI creation?
Well, what I would do is I would essentially take, if you already have an app and you're looking to go to iOS and Android, like take that code and take all that code that's in that click handler and put it in like a portable class library or a shared code project and really architect an MVVM way. And then I would, you know, learning mobile in general is difficult. Like learning one is hard, so learning three or four is going to be times four, right? So start with one. Just pick your favorite. Like let's say you only have a Windows machine, well, go with Android. If you have a Mac sitting around, then pick whatever device you like in your hand. I'm an Android guy. I carry around Android all day, so I really tend to go towards Android. So go there. Start there, right? Just go for it. I would say last, try Xamarin Forms, because Xamarin Forms is this abstraction layer across the common controls and common navigation paradigms. So if you don't know how iOS and Android work, when you start running a Xamarin Forms app on an Android or iOS device, you're like, man, okay, well, I want to do that thing, and then why is it a little bit different here? But it's like, okay, because it's supposed to be doing that on the platform. So I think it's kind of to your benefit to go learn a little bit of iOS and Android and then Xamarin Forms, because there's different scenarios where Xamarin Forms is going to be great, but then you may want to go down the traditional Xamarin approach and build out a beautiful native user interface for you.
So does it mean that using Xamarin Form, the user experience for the application will be like, okay, it looks like the application for my OS. I can see no major differences in how the application behaves, how the menus are, and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. What the team did, as I said, all right, well, you have a button, and it's an iOS button, it's an Android button, it's a Windows button. But even the navigation, like how things pop up and how things go down and how things navigate in and out, it's the native implementation under the hood. So it's not like they're doing any custom drawing or anything like that. It's still the native calls as if you were in iOS and Android. So when you're on an Android device, it's all material design. You have card views. You have flyout navigation on iOS, you probably have some tabs. I built the Xamarin Evolve conference application. We had our big Xamarin Evolve conference in Orlando a few months ago. And you can download that app on the App Store on iOS, Android, and Windows 10. And you'll see it looks very similar on each. It's the same functionality, but it looks like an iOS app, it looks like an Android app, and it looks like a Windows 10 app, you know.
Like with following the guidelines for those platforms.
Exactly, yeah. And that shares about 95% of code, which is really awesome.
Perfect.
Yeah. That's great.
And do you think it makes sense to just look into the pure Objective-C iOS development first, or just try Xamarin iOS?
It's a great question. You can try to, like me, I've been a C# developer since like 2005, right? So like I found C#, I found .NET, and that's all I ever wanted to do. I've definitely spun up, did file new project Objective-C, and like I ran it, and I was like, look at all these stars and brackets and stuff. I'm like, I don't really want to go down that. After a few years, you start being able to translate like Objective-C or Swift into C Sharp, though, because the nice thing about Xamarin is that all the names of the methods and everything are the same. So we have amazing documentation. But sometimes like a new feature will come out and you're like, oh, I'm going to download the sample from WWDC and I may want to run it just to try a new thing. But I knew Java, before, like a lowercase stuff, right? You know Java a little bit ahead of time. Objective-C and Swift, like I think it's fun to learn new languages, but I don't think it's a requirement. I think that when I started 5 years ago, I went full steam ahead with Xamarin because to me, I'm still building a native application. So everything I'm learning with Xamarin applies to if I was building with those native languages.
That's right.
So it's like I'm just building a native app, but in C Sharp. That's what's beautiful.
Okay.
So having Xamarin as a part of Microsoft family is kind of cool and hot stuff.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So can you feel any cultural difference after the acquisition?
Well, I think you know we've always had this great partnership with Microsoft. So we've for many years, we had this great partnership. We were up on stage at Build and Connect events and things like that, and just amazing integration of Visual Studio. I think when everyone found out about the acquisition, everyone was super excited. Mm-hmm. It was a natural fit. The teams here were excited on campus. We're here in 25 in Channel 9 Studios. Everyone was excited. We were excited. I think, if anything, it's just kind of seeing like this vision of mobile, like where is mobile going to go at Microsoft? Mm-hmm. And I think that Xamarin has that knowledge to kind of help craft some of this vision, at least when it comes to iOS, Android, and Mac, but also having .NET everywhere, you know, having Miguel and the team come over, a lot of people that originally worked on Mono and having them all together. So I think everyone's just really exciting. There's obviously changes going from a smaller company, you know, Xamarin's about 350 employees, Microsoft's a lot of employees, really, we were in, we had employees in 15 countries, but I think Microsoft's employees in every country, right, that you can think of. But it's really exciting. I was just at some big events here in Seattle, and just so much excitement. I think just everyone is really excited. But it's not only just us, right? The development community, your listeners, everyone here, like everyone's excited, right? I mean, when the acquisition happened and Build happened, right? It's free, it's open source, right? And then we go to Evolve, and like everything's open source, and we have this Windows, you know, iOS simulator, and like we have all this cool stuff going on. So it's a really exciting time.
So basically, it's kind of perfect fit, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I'm excited. I'm excited to be here. Yeah, and I live in Seattle, and they didn't force me to come into campus. I still work at home, so that's really good. And you know, a lot of Xamarin is based out of San Francisco or Boston, and everyone just, you know, stays where they're at. So it's not like we have to move around or do anything crazy. It's just, where are we going to be the most productive? And it's kind of like this new Microsoft people have been saying for 2 or 3 years now, right? And I think if you feel that.
Yeah, new Microsoft way works from anywhere.
Yeah,
that's what we do in Prague as well. Yeah. Every developer has its own sort of a bucket list, a list of apps they are excited about in their mind and then don't have a second or the time to build them. What's on yours?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, I've shipped a lot of apps to the App Store over the years when I was first working for a company and at Xamarin. I've shipped a lot for our conferences or for samples. And I think for me, like, I have a really big passion for coffee. If people ever listen to me talk about anything, I build little samples about coffee. I'm always demoing about coffee. I drink a lot of coffee. I've always had this vision just to kind of make the barista process really interesting, more interactive experience and a connection with the espresso machine, but also make a connection in like a actual coffee shop when you go. I think there's a lot of interesting things, whether how people are tampering or seeing things, and kind of building some coffee experience application would be interesting. So like a reason like why and how you would get this coffee or another. When you walk into a coffee shop and you see all these different like names and things, like what are these things? But having some interactive application to help you do that and find more about the coffee, order the coffee, and then when you get home with that coffee, learn how to properly grind it and make a perfect coffee. Mm. So I think that's kind of missing, and there's a lot of different apps that do a little bit different stuff, but it'd be a cool project that I would love to work
on. So maybe, what's your favorite coffee brand? Because we are in Seattle.
Yeah,
we are in Mount Redmond, but Seattle, you know.
There's a lot of great coffee in Seattle and in Redmond. The best coffee in Seattle is a tiny little place. It's about the size of where we're sitting right now. And in Studio B, it is called Monorail Espresso. It's right by the convention center. There's just one person working. It's been there since 1980. And it's the best espresso drinks in the whole city. Besides that, like Vivace and Victrola are really good. Yeah, those are like probably the top spots. And they make great espresso drinks, great drip coffee, like at Victrola. It's kind of a staple in the city, if you will. Everyone would say, oh, there's Starbucks, right? There's Starbucks everywhere. It's definitely Starbucks coffee. But there's a really cool Starbucks roastery. They built this huge, crazy, they spent millions of dollars on it, and it's up on Capitol Hill. And it's a cool experience to go to. But the coffee still tastes like Starbucks coffee. Yeah. So you can make it look pretty, right? Doesn't mean it's not going to be Starbucks coffee. So, yeah.
You really know your thing.
I love it. It's like I love coffee, I love apps, and I love the community that we have. So it's great. Yeah.
Do you have anything else, or should I shoot the last question?
I think you should shoot the last one.
Okay, don't be scared.
Okay, this wasn't in the pre-briefing.
I know. How long does it take to get from Seattle to Prague?
Oh, that's a great question. So if I go from Seattle to London, that's 9 hours. And then if you go to probably a layover in Heathrow. And then in Heathrow, you're going to go through 18 security checkpoints and you're going to stamp stuff. That's about a five-hour experience. It's because there's probably no direct. So I bet that you're probably looking at a 16-hour day plus a 8, 9, 10 hours, 24 hours probably with the time change.
With a time shift.
That's a different view. Okay.
Yeah. I used to fly a lot from Phoenix to Romania a lot when I used to work at a few previous jobs. And it was always like a 24-hour adventure. So.
Yeah, that's what happened to us. We were up for 24 hours.
Yeah.
So you're right.
Well, there you go.
Perfect. Yep.
Really, like, good. Thank you very much for taking the time and being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Thank you for being with us.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thanks.
A poselství pro naše diváky je jasné. Programujte, učte se nové technologie, zkoušejte multiplatformní vývoj a hlavně C#.
Dejte za Marinu šanci.
8. dílu. Doufám, že se vám tohle sestavení líbilo, nám se líbilo moc. Doufám, že tady nejsme naposled.
Moc jsme si to užili.
I když na nějakou dobu asi ano, ale určitě se zase někdy podíváme. A programujte, zkoušejte, budeme se těšit zase příště.
Díky a na viděnou. Ahoj.